This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
If there was a big red button that would just demolish the internet, I would smash that button with my forehead.
From the BBC, this is The Interface, the show that explores how tech is rewiring your week and your world.
This isn't about quarterly earnings or about tech reviews.
It's about what technology is actually doing to your work, your politics, your everyday life.
And all the bizarre ways people are using the internet.
Listen on BBC.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Last December, the Australians brought in a ban on under-16s being able to access social media. It's a move lots of other governments are considering, including ours. Here, we're about to launch a public consultation on children's use of social media, and this week, even before the consultation, the government said it wants to create new legal powers so it can take action quickly. But what does the evidence currently available tell us about whether and how young people are harmed by social media? What might any ban look like? And would it work? Step into the briefing room and together we'll find out. First, let's look at what's happening with that social media ban for under-16s in Australia. I'm joined by the BBC's Australia correspondent, Katie Watson. Katie Watson, can you describe the pressure that led up to this ban?
It wasn't initially about the pressure. I think it's a funny story, actually, because the South Australia Premier, Peter Malinauskas, he is actually credited with kickstarting this ban. His wife was reading a book called The Anxious Generation by Jonathan Haidt, which looks at the mental health issues among the smartphone generation. And she put the book down, finished it, and told her husband to read it, and then told him to do something about it. And then it snowballed. So he got other states interested. He got the federal government interested. Then there were also national campaigns, like media campaigns, encouraging people to back a ban. So it kind of, the momentum grew. But as for the pressure, I think it was more that there was a lack of opposition. It was an easy ride. So that's why it moved so quickly, as opposed to the actual pressure. People just thought this was a no-brainer.
Okay, so let's get into the weeds of this. What is banned and for who?
There are 10 platforms, which are Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, Snapchat, X, YouTube, Reddit, Threads, Twitch, and Kick. So anybody under 16 is officially no longer able to access those platforms. So what the companies had was a year between December 24, when the legislation was passed, up until last December the 10th, to come up with age verification software or checks, basically, to make sure that they weren't letting under 16s access their platforms. So that's what they spent a year doing, that there were trials. It was up to the companies to work out what software worked for them, but they now have to be compliant. So as of the December the 10th, if they're not compliant, if they're found to be allowing under 16s on their platforms, then the eSafety Commission effectively can come after them and they can face fines of up to $49.5 million Australian dollars. That's about 25, 26 million pounds.
I imagine that the tech companies in the initial stages weren't that pleased by this idea.
That is very true. I don't think any of them were happy. All of them have said they'll comply. I think they don't have much choice, but they've all been pretty critical of it, arguing it's not the right approach. In fact, Reddit filed a challenge in the High Court just a couple of days after the restrictions. And they effectively said that while they agreed with protecting people under 16, the law, I quote, has the unfortunate effect of forcing intrusive and potentially insecure verification processes on adults as well as minors. They said it was an illogical patchwork of platforms that were included in the ban, because that's what's quite interesting. Like, why those 10? Messaging apps are not part of it. Neither is gaming. There were plenty of parents who couldn't quite understand why, given that there are kind of social media aspects to some, you know, gaming platforms, why they weren't included. But the government says that they are keeping an eye on different platforms.
How have they done the age verification?
So it all depends on the platform. So it could be facial recognition, uploading ID, a mixture of both, inputting all your data. So, yeah, I mean, that's the thing. But even the head of the age verification trial said that nothing is kind of impossible to get through.
Katie, how do you think it's working out so far?
The government released some data shortly after the ban started, saying that in the first few weeks of the ban, 4.7 million accounts were closed. And of that, Meta said 500,000 of them were theirs. So is that success? 4.7 million is a big number. It doesn't answer whether those accounts have closed, but kids have opened other accounts that are not part of the ban. And what are those accounts? What kind of safety features do they have? That's a big concern. I think it's really difficult to measure success in this. And it will take years for that success to be measured properly. A lot of kids got emails or text messages ahead of the ban saying they were going to be kicked off. And so some were. But I've spoken to a lot of people who say nothing's changed. They never got that email. They'd never been kicked off. But I think a lot of kids have been quite savvy. I was doing another interview for BBC a few weeks ago, and a group of five boys stopped me and said, "Oh, what are you talking about?" And I said, "Oh, social media." And they went, "Oh, doesn't work. We're all on it. Nothing's changed." And I think that's kind of the view from a lot of people, which the government says that's fine, that they actually expected that. The government said that will be the case, especially the kind of 14, 15-year-olds who are fully on social media. But actually, the government is also wanting to focus on the younger people. So they're age 9 who don't have a social media account yet. And they might not now because of this law and because none of their friends are going to have it. They talk about the circuit breaker effect. Basically, nobody's going to have it. And so it takes the pressure off. And that is what is going to change childhood.
Katie Watson. Let's leave the warmth of Sydney and return to wet and wintry Blighty and the state of public opinion here on this issue. I'm joined by Luke Trill, who's UK director of the polling organisation More in Common. Luke Trill, we've just been hearing about the social media ban in Australia, and we know the issue is going out to consultation here in Britain. But what are you finding in your polling and focus groups that the general public feel about social media and a potential ban for young people?
Well, at a top line, there is quite strong support for raising the age at which children can use social media up to 16. In our last poll on this, we found that around 75% of UK adults supported raising the age limit. And it's not just one of those issues where, you know, people say that because they're asked about it in a poll. What we've been finding is, particularly in focus groups with parents and particularly mums, it is coming up unprompted, the issue of social media and its harms, when we ask people about the big issues facing the country. And in fact, I did a focus group in Scotland just a couple of days ago. This was with a group of mums, and I asked them the big issues facing the country, and it was cost of living, NHS, and then social media harms and what it was doing to young people.
In what kind of language would that be raised with you? I mean, what would the first person to talk about it normally say why this was a big issue for them?
So normally it's based on their own experience. So it will be, you know, a parent saying, "I just can't get my son or daughter off their mobile phone." Very often you get, you know, they totally change when they're on it. And this sense that it's almost sort of ruining the experience of parenting for them as well. And the interesting thing is, because, of course, you hear the pushback from some people about the idea of a ban, that, well, shouldn't parents just, you know, control their own kids and set rules and limits? What comes up consistently in these focus groups is, I would love to stop them using social media, but I can't do it on my own because my son or daughter says that they'll be bullied, they'll be ostracized. So it really does, at least in their minds, appear to be a sort of classic collective action problem.
Insofar as you can, both from focus groups and polling, are people more concerned about the harms, in other words, the kind of sorts of cases that you hear about, or are they more concerned about, if you like, the social consequences of people looking at social media or looking at their phones all the time?
So if you'd asked me this 18 months ago, what tended to come up in focus groups was the high profile cases where, you know, people might have been, you know, bullied very severely or groomed online. And I still think those, you know, most severe harms are front of mind. But there's definitely been a shift, as there was in this focus group of mums that I ran a few days ago, to worrying about kind of wider things. What does it mean for young people's attention span? That comes up quite a lot. Is my son or daughter less sociable than they used to be? Are they able to go out in the world and interact with people. And so there does just seem to have been this shift from what you might call the sort of classic and obviously more severe harms through to this sense that it's actually having an effect on us as people and a society as well. I should say, I mean, another group, not just of parents in Scotland, in Glasgow shortly after that group, and they wanted to switch social media off for everyone, which is a rather more extreme proposition. They talked about how as adults, they found their own attention span was weaker as a result.
Luke Trill. And before we move on, a reminder about the Briefing Room podcast. If you visit BBC Sounds, you can find the entire back catalogue, such as the one which asks what's happening in Iran following last month's protests and what will happen if the Americans decide to intervene, and the one that looks at the bottleneck in training places for early career doctors.
If there was a big red button that would just demolish the internet, I would smash that button with my forehead.
From the BBC, this is The Interface, the show that explores how tech is rewiring your week and your world.
This isn't about quarterly earnings or about tech reviews.
It's about what technology is actually doing to your work, your politics, your everyday life.
And all the bizarre ways people are using the internet.
Listen on bbc.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Now back to social media. To discuss what the evidence does and doesn't tell us and what action on the issue might look like, I'm joined by Amy Auburn, a research professor at the MRC Cognition and Brain Sciences Unit at the University of Cambridge, Sonia Livingston, who's professor in the Department of Media and Communications at the London School of Economics, and Pete Etchells, who's professor of psychology and science communication at Bath Spa University. Can I start with you, Pete Etchells? Which countries that you're aware of, apart from the UK, are considering following Australia's ban?
More and more, day by day, I think, actually. So we've heard so far from, but not restricted to, Portugal. They're looking at restricting social media and other platforms for children under the age of 16. Spain, over the past couple of weeks, similarly looking at restricting for under 16-year-olds. France is looking at restricting social media for under 15-year-olds, and they're doing that alongside a proposed ban on mobile phones in high schools. Just in the past couple of days, we've heard more information from Germany considering a social media ban. This might be aimed at under 14s. So more and more countries are coming online with this very quickly.
Let's now talk about the evidence. What evidence is there currently that social media use is adversely affecting young people's mental health? Amy Auburn, if I could start with you.
My team and led a large consortium commissioned by government to look into this question. Sonia was part of that as well. We did a specific review just looking at time spent on social media because that's what a ban would manipulate. It would change the amount of time young people spend on social media and its impact on mental health and well-being in under 18s. So there's a huge array of different studies, but a lot of them are correlational. So they can just tell us whether children who use more social media also feel worse. And that is the case. So it's a small negative correlation. There are also longitudinal studies that can show whether if one teenager starts using more social media in 1 year, how does that predict their mental health 1 year later? That has more mixed evidence, but you could say it shows that there is a potential for some small negative predictions as well. But critically, we didn't find that we could make good causal claims that actually time spent on social media did change mental health. So we can say it might. And the real limitation was that there was no study in healthy under 18s that had reduced or removed social media to see what happens. There was one study in teenagers that showed mental health distress already that did show that a social media reduction improved their outcomes slightly. And then actually just last week, there was a preprint that came out, which is a non-peer-reviewed study. So as academic researchers, you go through a rigorous process of peer review. This is when people upload it beforehand saying, well, you've just submitted this to a journal, where they did reduce social media use in healthy under 18s of about an hour a day. These were Danish teenagers, and they didn't find any changes in well-being after that. But naturally, a lot of this debate is about much more than well-being or mental health and much more than just time spent online. And that's where the evidence base does change. There's particularly better evidence around content and harmful content. There is also different evidence based on educational outcomes, on sexual exploitation. So a lot of these concerns are about more than mental health or well-being.
Sonia Livingston, what's your take on the same issue and what it is we can reliably say? And we say this against the background of what we've already heard, that people do already have pretty strong opinions about whether or not it's causing harm.
You know, when we try to generalise what is the effect of all children using more or less social media on their overall well-being, it becomes really very, very hard to generalise. And I think, I agree with Amy's characterisation. But for particular harms, and actually also, I might say, particular benefits, there's lots of evidence. It stays broadly correlational, but children who are bullied more online are more unhappy. It's not a surprise. Children who are exposed to more sexual content online or sexual violent content online, that's associated with misogynistic images or pejorative images of sex or indeed anxiety. Children who find themselves seeing a lot of pro self-harm content or dieting content, you know, we can find correlations with their self-image, with their self-confidence. The correlations, the associations are, you know, never overwhelming. So we could never say, if you see this content, if you're exposed to this, this will be the inevitable outcome. It will always depend on a whole host of factors to do with the children's context, children's resilience, what other kinds of messaging they're getting, and how vulnerable they are in their lives.
We're talking a lot about the negatives here. Are there any benefits to children being engaged with social media?
There is lots of evidence of benefits. Many surveys, many qualitative studies with children hear that they learn from social media, that they are getting their news from social media. It's entertaining. It's funny. It contributes to a kind of a shared culture of childhood.
Pete Etchells, I want to make a distinction now between the evidence about, if you like, the mass of people and the evidence of harms to specific groups from specific forms of social media. What have you made of the extensive stories of experience of significant harms from social media use?
I mean, they're harrowing, obviously, and they're important stories to both tell, but also to listen to. It is something that I think we struggle with as scientists in the area. How can you possibly come along and say, well, the population level data suggests that it's not clear, when lots of other people can come along and say, well, look, here is clear evidence of harm in this particular situation. And I think that's where we need to be careful about how we treat these different forms of evidence that both have value in this space, but we shouldn't set them up as competing against each other. That it is absolutely right that there are individual cases and specific circumstances where demonstrable harm is occurring and that we need to do something about that. But at the same time, at a broad scale, at the population level data, the sort that Amy was talking about, we don't see those, what you might expect to be massive effects, translating through to that level. We very often get stuck in thinking about this in terms of exposure-based harms. You know, we ask questions on lines of, you know, if you spend more time on a particular platform, can we link that in any meaningful way to an increase in harm or an increase in a particular benefit? And we've got hundreds, thousands of studies in this area that do that sort of thing now. They don't show consistent or clear evidence one way or another, because it's likely the case that they're not measuring the things that they need to measure, that there's more often than not other factors that haven't been considered, that haven't been controlled for.
You seem to be saying, Pete, that what can sometimes happen is we reach for a single explanation when in fact there are a multitude of factors behind what you might describe as some of the individual cases that we hear about.
Yeah, and at the same time, it could very well be the case that social media is the main driving factor. But the point is that we don't know. But we very often think about this in terms of, is there one big thing that changed at some point that would explain this other big thing that we're worried about, whether that's a reduction in childhood mental health or bullying or educational attainment, whatever it is.
Well, I'd like to go back to Amy on this question, because it interests me about the problem of doing research in this field, because you've been doing a lot and I think experiencing quite a lot of difficulty with getting some of the research information that you needed.
Yes, doing good quality work in this area is very difficult. If I want to study a certain aspect of childhood, it's often quite easy to, for example, go to a playground and see what young people are doing. When we want to see what they're doing on social media, that requires us to have access to those spaces which are privatized, and social media companies have been cutting down on how we can access good quality data about what young people are doing online. So that's why we often study self-reported time spent on social media.
Sorry, I mean, why have they been doing that?
That's up for the companies to tell you. But I think we do know that accountability matters. And I think they've been getting away with a very low amount of accountability. And I think that has to change.
Sonia, can I go back to you on the question of some of the areas where we can make the biggest links between harms and individual people? What would you regard as the most kind of problematic areas?
My sense is that the most problematic areas and the most problematic harms is the personalization of kind of algorithmic feeds in ways that different people are getting fed different kinds of content, sometimes problematic content, in ways that is targeted to their particular triggers and their particular vulnerabilities. A hypothetic example might be you open a new profile and you say, I'm an 11-year-old girl and I'm feeling a bit worried about, you know, how I look. And then in the kind of next minutes or hours or weeks, you're offered content, offered images about diet, about weight loss, about possibly cosmetic surgery that might push you down a pathway to actually begin to feel worse about yourself and to think about more extreme kinds of solutions.
Amy, you wanted to come in.
Yes, I think naturally there are other areas of public health where even very small amount of severe harms to small proportions of the population see very large scale change. We've seen that, for example, with allergens, where certain deaths of young people have led to changes that, you know, probably impact how we're treated when we enter a restaurant and given our menu. And I think that we as a society should safeguard individuals, and individual level harm should be enough to hold companies to account and make sure we are safeguarding the most vulnerable. So some people might say, well, if a toy has caused the death of 5 children, then why are you asking to show that the time spent playing on the toy impacts well-being on a population level? And I completely agree with them. It shows us that we need to act. But then also we might say, well, we would retract that toy, but we wouldn't retract all toys. And it's about proportionality. And so the flashpoint has been about bans because it impacts the whole population of young people. And so we need to weigh up those risks and benefits. And naturally, there are ways that we can also safeguard the most vulnerable and while not banning. So I think we shouldn't say, is it a ban or not? It's like, what should we do as well as potentially banning to make sure that we're safeguarding everyone, children, adults, those who are most vulnerable?
Well, let's look at that kind of range of options as to what you actually do, informed by what the three of you have said about what evidence is available and what isn't. The caveat I mentioned earlier was the one that many parents have about simply the attention deficit being caused actually, essentially, by accessing what's on a phone at any given time, which we haven't really addressed, but which I understand, Amy, from you, the evidence is not really clear on it.
The evidence around attention has been mixed for a really long time. There's been some studies showing that just the presence of a phone changes exam scores, but I also examined a thesis where they tried to replicate that and they couldn't find that there. So I think naturally, if there are real concerns in the population, that does show that we need to have a look and really understand that. And I do think what Sonia said, that we are getting ever more powerful technologies and young people are increasingly telling us they find it very difficult to self-control their use. And it's an attention economy. It's about commercializing attention of us and of our children. So I do think that shows an issue, even if the perfect evidence isn't there. There is this really interesting study in Denmark where they trialed, for example, adding a 6-second delay when young people enter their social media app. And they found that that reduced their social media use by about 30% without reducing enjoyment, showing that actually quite a lot of use probably just is maybe habitual and is a bit, quote unquote, out of control.
Sonia, that's really fascinating. And it prompts me to ask you this slightly kind of impertinent question, which is, why would we anticipate that children would agree to come off social media when they see what their parents do?
Well, I think parents are probably reflecting quite deeply at the moment as well. And also, there is something about the cultural norm. If everyone is doing it, then I'll do it. And that affects parents as well as children. There is also something about the way in which the platforms are designed to keep and hold our attention for as long as possible. They're all finding ways to put in, you know, more infinite scroll, more reels. And even if we don't have great evidence yet that that is reducing people's concentration span, I think we can make a kind of argument based on children's rights that tech, as well as society, needs to leave children to be free to make their own decisions, to think for themselves, to choose what they want to look at next. And that's sort of there in the Online Safety Act, and it's quite strongly there in the Digital Services Act that applies in Europe, which is to say, at least for children and young people, there should not be that constant call on their attention through scrolling or through endless recommendations.
But Pete Etchell, that raises the question of why we don't just do that. Why don't we just implement the provisions that we've already got for the population as a whole, which might therefore deal with quite a lot of the problems we think we may be saving up for the younger generation?
Yeah, I think it's easier said than done. I think there are problems here around if you place particular restrictions on a particular platform that happens to not be based in the UK, given the current climate of politics at the minute, that could have ramifications beyond this part of the conversation.
Sorry, Pete, do you mean that if we try to regulate what American tech companies largely put into their services to us, then the Americans might retaliate against us? Is that what we're talking about?
Well, we're already seeing that with fines through the Online Safety Act, that they're simply not paying them because their lawyers are coming out and saying the only jurisdiction here is US jurisdiction, so we're not going to pay attention to this.
So to wrap it all up, imagine for a moment that I'm Keir Starmer and I've called you in for a very quick consultation about this because he wants to know what to do. Sonia, what would you advise him?
I think we've spent 10 years or more debating the Online Safety Act and a range of other forms of legislation here and also in Europe, and we should implement it. I think if we can't implement it, if we can't enforce it, if we don't stand behind that and update it as needed, then we are just saying big tech can do whatever it likes and our children do become the casualties.
Pete Etchells, you're in the lift with Keir Starmer. He's only going to the third floor. What do you tell him?
So I think if we're going to put bans in, then put grandfather clauses in so that we don't create cliff edges. So that could be at 13, it could be at 11 when children go to secondary school, and it increases by 1 year for however many years until we get to 16. And crucially, do that alongside digital literacy programs across the board from an early age.
Amy Orban, what do you think he should do?
I think it's inherently a question that goes beyond the evidence because it's a question about risk. Do we put in place something where we don't know exactly how effective it is. And so there are risks about unintended consequences. But naturally, we would be acting versus about delaying, for example, to figure out what else to do or to look at the Australian ban and harms potentially accumulating. And that weighing up of risk isn't just about evidence. Evidence can inform that, but it's also about morals, personal judgment, and it's about what your constituents want. And I think we need to be honest that there won't be anything here that is a silver bullet, and that even if we decide on a ban, this will require long-term change, just as we ban alcohol for under 18s, but we still need to have a mechanism in place to deal with alcohol use in young age groups.
That's all we've got time for. My thanks to Amy Orban, Sonia Livingston, Pete Etchells, Katie Watson and Luke Trill. And my conclusion? Oh, sorry, I was just distracted there by my phone. Somebody's organised a Twitter pile-on. We'll be back at the same time next week. Goodbye. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Caroline Bailey and Kirstine Knight. The production coordinator was Maria Ogundeli. The sound engineer was James Beard. And the editor was Richard Varden. Another edition of this podcast will be along again very soon.
I'm Eleni Jones.
And I'm Mark Kermode. And in Screenshot, we guide you through the ever-changing landscape of the moving image.
I really like any story about self-delusion.
My intent is to allow the audience to see The Shining through these people's eyes.
Meeting those on both sides of the camera.
And uncovering fascinating insights into what we watch.
How would you describe the difference between the doppelganger and the clone?
Why is it such a cinematic subject?
What was your relationship like with your double?
Screenshot from BBC Radio 4.
Listen now on BBC Sounds.
If there was a big red button that would just demolish the internet, I would smash that button with my forehead.
From the BBC, this is The Interface, the show that explores how tech is rewiring your week and your world.
This isn't about quarterly earnings or about tech reviews.
It's about what technology is actually doing to your work, your politics, your everyday life.
And all the bizarre ways people are using the internet.
Listen on bbc.com or wherever you get your podcasts.